Accession number 10403, reel 9.
Mr. Harold Sell, Reel 9. You were talking about the lack of effective anti-tank weapons. What did you think of the two you were issued with, the £2 of the French affair and the boys' anti-tank rifle, as far as you know?
Well, so far as the boys' anti-tank rifle, it's exactly what it said it was. It was a larger calibre rifle and was quite unable to penetrate the armour of the German tanks. The two-pounder, the French gun, was a Hotchkiss gun. It was a very good gun, but it lacked the penetrating power or the size of the round to do any effect or to penetrate the armour. We also used our own field gun, which was the 25-pounder, in an anti-tank role using solid shot. They, of course, were effective to a very short range, but the range at which they were effective meant they were within the ranges of the tank's own armament, so that unless they hit them with the first shot, they themselves were gunners. These 25-pounders, of course, were issued only to field batteries, and what we lacked was within the unit, within the battalion, an anti-tank weapon.
And you were very conscious of this at Brigade HQ from the reports coming in from the battalions, were you?
Well, I was personally very conscious of it because having seen some German tanks engaged with the two-pounder, with our anti-tank platoon, anti-tank company, could see that they would be ineffective against the best tanks. If what we had were the best tanks put against us, quite ineffective.
Did you expect the German tanks to be as they were, or did you think they were as good or better than British tanks?
The German tanks turned out to be much better than we thought they were. We didn't think that their armour resistance was as good as it was. And it certainly could deflect shot very well. The German tank was a good one.
What about the British tank? How did that compare?
Well, we had the Matilda. We had the infantry tank, which was a very big tank, which was a 40-ton tank. It was very, very slow and cumbersome. And, of course, the result was that it could not accelerate quickly to deal with a position which might arise in an open field position. It was a good tank so far as it went, but it couldn't fulfil the requirements that was a modern battle wanted it. The Germans, on the other hand, had the 88mm gun, and that was the thing which went throughout the war. It was originally an anti-aircraft gun which they had adapted for anti-tank role. And it certainly saw us off.
Were you expecting it? Were you aware of the Germans' possession of this weapon?
Not really. I mean, we knew they had this gun, but of course, if you read that the Germans are equipped with an 88mm, you don't really know what it is until they fire it at you. And in the 88mm high-velocity gun, the bullet hit you before you heard the bang. It was such a high-velocity gun.
Did you think you were trained adequately in working? I mean, you actually worked with the tanks. You made the assault.
Yes, we made. Had
you practiced enough, do you think? And was the practice that you'd done, the training you'd done, realistic in action?
It was as realistic as it could be. But, of course, you never get sufficient training in peacetime with ancillary arms. It's a sort of thing that you have got to live with them, and they've got to live with you.
What about air support? Were you satisfied with the reconnaissance and actual defensive capacities of the RAF?
We never saw any RAF at all. I can't remember seeing one RAF plane until a recce plane came over the beaches. I can't remember seeing one. There was, of course, complete air superiority to the Germans.
Did you understand why that was, or did you feel, or was there any bitterness towards the RAF? Did you feel that they should be...
We didn't understand, because it was not in our province to have the information that they were really concerned about the invasion of England. The only thing that that we were thinking was that the RAF had been taken and used on another theatre of the front, which was probably more vital than we were.
So at the time, you didn't feel bitter. You didn't know what the reason was, but you accepted that there was a reason why they weren't about.
Oh, yes. You said, well, why the devil don't they come here for a change? I mean, that was the attitude. Why somebody else gone? And why can't we have a chance? This was really the attitude. There wasn't a question of damning them or anything like that. Some people might have damned them, but they weren't there. And at Vimy, we were promised their support, and they never turned up. But, I mean, we were far too engaged to worry about whether an aircraft had come or not.
What about the Royal Navy and the activities of the small boats, in support? How did you feel? Did you feel that they'd done everything that could be expected or not?
Well, the Navy, of course, were very limited, because they were completely... You can't have a large boat in the channel when you've got no air superiority. And you, therefore, I presume they were precluded from sending things like cruisers or heavier vessels in. But you had smaller vessels like destroyers and, I suppose, minesweepers all buzzing about all over the top, zigzagging all over the place. And the civilian boats were... There was quite a lot of civilian boats, French and British, of all shapes and sizes.
Were you aware of the effort that was being made to get you off?
I think we were aware of the effort being made, but we were mystified by the appearance of all the civilian craft. We weren't aware that the complete abandonment of France had taken place, and that in our minds the evacuation of Dunkirk was an evacuation of that sector. And it may well have been that we were being taken to be regrouped and pushed into France again lower down the coast. That was our feeling at the time.
Now, the next thing is, I've asked you specifically to do this. We discussed it earlier. Could you give us a complete account of what happened to Miller? I know we've touched on it before, but this is in response to, in a view to refute certain allegations that have been made about Miller's conduct, by giving us a detailed account of what happened to Miller and how it came to happen to him and the group of 150 that were with him that day at Vimy. If you could take it through from the start.
Well, seeing you've made this this request and also indicated that there is some controversy about the incident, I will recall what I remember quite clearly of the incident and when I was there, and I will give it to you in as measured words as I may, in order that there can be no ambiguity about the circumstances. At the time of the withdrawal of the 6th DLI in the Battle of Arras, and at the time when Colonel Miller had Peter Jeffrey's company's overrun, and he himself was withdrawing under brigade instructions along the same route and back to Acrey, which was the advance brigade headquarters, there were considerable number of casualties. And all transport that was available was being used to bring them back. And in this transport, Colonel Miller's own vehicle was placed by him. He himself then marched with the troops along the road back towards Ikuri. Bearing in mind at that time there was no news or no idea of what had happened to that part of the battalion, which everybody had thought had been completely overrun. I can only emphasize, even at that time, the great fatigue under which men, as well as the officers, were working. It was a physical fatigue, it was a mental fatigue of fighting, marching, lack of food, lack of sleep, not adequate water. Colonel, at that time, I was forward at Ikuri and forward on the road towards Arras. Colonel Miller arrived, I think, with his party at Ikuri on foot, possibly 2 o'clock in the morning, or it might have been earlier in the morning, but it was at that sort of a time. He and his party were directed into a barn or some outbuilding to try and rest. Brigade headquarters was functioning normally. The whole position was placed on the battle board. The intention of where the troops were to go and the position to which they were to return to was also clearly marked on the battle board. The brigade commander had actually spoken to Colonel Miller. And so far as I know, although I was not present, he had indicated that they were returning to our previously held positions on Vimy Ridge.
That was Hullock in that case.
Vimy Ridge, no. I, in my own mind, was in no doubt about the intention. The brigade major was extended in looking after the details of withdrawal of the 8th DLI and also getting the 9th DLI back, as well as the 6th. The brigade IO was completely immersed in collating all the information, getting information out. So it was a time when everybody was at full stress. I left advance headquarters and went back to rear brigade at Petit Vimy onto the ridge in order to organize the checkpoints and the reception of troops which were coming in and to see that they would be directed to their areas and the erection of signs on the road to direct each unit, which was the standard drill. The B echelons were alerted and they were either ready for departure or they were, all the cooks were preparing meals in order to either have food for the troops or food sent to them. During that period, Colonel Miller had renewed his march towards Vimy Ridge along the main road. He was with his troops, possibly two companies.
Had he seen the battle board?
It is a standard drill that every officer passing through brigade headquarters or any headquarters on arrival and on leaving scrutinise the battle board and ask questions if necessary from the duty officer. And of course one would have expected that Colonel Miller and or the officers with him at that time would have made themselves aware of what was on the battle board and what was in the mind of the commander. Early the morning, and when I say to me the morning started 3 o'clock in the morning, I was forward making certain that the details of where people went to and where they came back to and was as near as perfect one could make it, and also to make certain that there might be any refugees that would interfere with the movements were diverted from the road. I do know that the position was aware to the officers at B echelon, which was in the rear. And so far as the 6th DLI was concerned, the transport officer quite properly went forward, went down the road on his vehicle to find out and see what assistance he could give. He met Colonel Miller marching somewhere along the road between A. Curie and Petit Vimy. He then went back and collected either two or three tonners, came back along the road, and the troops and Colonel Miller were taken into the three tonners. I also know at that time that the exhaustion was so complete that they would all be asleep the moment they got on board the vehicles. The head of the column of three vehicles, MTO may very well have given an instruction to the driver to report to the checkpoint. And of course the MTO would be far too busy to accompany the column himself and would go on his way. The column, I do know, and it must, pass the checkpoint. It passed the checkpoint and remained in an area, was put in an area under the trees, not far from Brigade Headquarters.
So near Petit Vimy?
Near Petit Vimy. All troops and everybody inside was so exhausted that they could not, food was not even sent to them. They were not disturbed. At that time, and at Brigade Headquarters, was Mike Ferrans, who was one of the 6 DLI officers, left LOB with B echelon, together with the quartermaster, who was at Brigade Headquarters, obviously trying to find out the latest position and instructions in order to supply the troops with food. By some reason, Colonel Miller's party, and he had some officers with him, so there were several people who would hear it, got the impression or was instructed that he had to go to Hullock, which was a little village or township about 3 miles down the road to La Bassée, which was the crossing point across the canal.
Now, in fact, he was supposed to have taken up positions on Vimy Ridge. Would that be correct?
A correct interpretation of the instructions and the intentions and what was on the board was that he would return to his original positions on the ridge and there become a defensive situation. That was the situation as at that time.
That was what you were expecting?
That was one would expect. That is what I understood to be the position, having been there and seen it.
Have you any idea how the Hullock theme, where that came from? Or was it just a misreading through fatigue of the battle board?
Hullock, the name Hullock was passed on by, it never appeared on the battle board. The name Hullock was an instruction, was supposed to have been passed to this particular little group to go and remain there. Following that, Colonel Miller's party went to Hullock and stayed by the side of the road. In his mind and in his view, and this I've verified from other officers who was there, awaiting for somebody to give him instructions, the intention of going back to the original positions appears not to have entered into the calculations at that time. Whilst they were there, an RA officer in charge of blowing the bridges at La Bassée Canal told Colonel Miller that he and his party must cross the bridge as they were going to blow it. he certainly, and I'd spoken to him since, had no idea that he had passed Brigade Headquarters, and that we were, when he stopped, within a very short distance. He obeyed this officer, took his party across the bridge, and on arrival in, and accompanying that party was Mike Ferrans. So Mike had been at Brigade Headquarters, had seen Colonel Miller, and was with his party when they went to Hulluck. Whilst in La Basse, an extremely heavy air raid took place, and the entire village or town was almost gutted. It was confusion everywhere. Civilians, military, all sorts. People running in all directions. And into this, middle of this, was this little column. When it was over, there were other units passing in all different directions. The column was split up. Bearing in mind the column was only of probably three vehicles at the most, and would be easily separated. And there would be nobody whipping them in. And that section under Major Ferrans and in the three tunnels with the troops in joined a column which eventually happened to turn up at the coast. He placed himself under their command. Colonel Miller went to the nearest headquarters, Corps headquarters, to find out where Brigade headquarters were. He went to Plouge Street, to the headquarters there, and ascertained that we were still on the ridge. He then retraced his steps, and bearing in mind all this went without sleep and without food and without any sort of recuperative rest, stayed the night in a little village, and the next day rejoined Brigade Headquarters. And at that point, I was present in Brigade Headquarters when he reported to the Brigade Commander.
What was your impression of his state?
At that time, Colonel Miller was in a state of such complete exhaustion that one could not manage that he could respond positively in any particular direction. There was lack of sleep, there was lack of food, and I don't suppose he had had much to drink. He had certainly, apart from all his battle experience, plus his march back, completely exhausted himself in his wanderings around, endeavouring to retrace and find Brigade Headquarters, which, to his credit, he did.
How many people were with him when he rejoined?
I think there was only just in one vehicle. Not very many. Now, he was then, by that time, Peter Jeffries had returned, and the battalion was reformed on Peter Jeffries, and Colonel Miller, who was so unfit as should be and was, evacuated.
Evacuated back to Dunkirk?
No, evacuated back, whoever, to the division and back onwards, back through the usual channels.
As a casualty, in fact.
As a casualty, virtually as a casualty. Now, when any circumstances occur in war for which there is a gap in events which are not chronicled or which cannot be readily explained, must be and is investigated. It's either by a court of inquiry or by an official explanation of what took place, following which a court of inquiry may or may not take place. In this particular instance, I recall as a brigade the letter which was written to Colonel Miller asking for him for an explanation of his movements between a certain time and another certain time on different dates. To my knowledge, there was no intention beyond this than to establish, beyond any doubt, the proper story and history which every unit and every officer is accountable to. And I, to my knowledge, cannot substantiate anything which should, in his conduct or handling with the battalion in battle, until when the overrunning of the tanks and things took place, which could be held not to his credit.
Now, he was, as a result of the inquiry, eventually, as you put it before, bowler hatted. Could you just explain why that was? Because that wasn't...
Well, the word, the term bowler hatted is a term which is a general term in the army. When you leave your command or you go somewhere else, for example, when my time was expired and the Queen had no further use for my services, I was bowler hatted. So the word bowler hatted does not contain any significance other than just a general term used in the army.
Why was he removed from his command, or his command ended?
Well, he at that time, of course, the command was an active command in the field in contact with the enemy. And whether he'd been hit by a bullet or hit on the head by a clod of earth, and he was not in a physical condition, then you do not command. Your command is taken over. That's no... necessarily a slur on the character of the individual.
So this exhaustion was the and the fear that it might recur without was the reason that he was...
Well, at that time, you could not allow anybody who was not in 100% control of all faculties to exercise command.
Would the reason he didn't get a subsequent command, to my knowledge, I don't know that for a fact, would that be because at his age... it was feared that the circumstances on active service might repeat themselves. He might again, especially, become exhausted.
Well, he was World War One man. He was over 50 years of age. He'd had a physical, not only a physical exhaustion, which did break many younger men, but he had, of course, all the mental strain of the battle itself, plus the fact at that time half of his battalion had been annihilated. It was a very great strain on the individual, whether it was on Colonel Miller or whether it was on anybody else. And I would not like to forecast how I would react if I was driven to that extent of exhaustion.
Now, just perhaps as an illustration of the effects of exhaustion, another thing you mentioned before was the state of the people you picked up on Vimy Ridge when you did your trawl and when you got left behind for stragglers. Could you describe the state of the men, just to give us an idea of what exhaustion did? These are people you picked up, what state they were in.
Well, the exhaustion was so great that they could not be woken up. You could not wake them up by shaking them. You could not wake them up by kicking them. You could not wake them up by pouring water from your water bottle over them. All you could do, if you roused them, and they were drowsy, all you could get from them would be, "Oh, to hell, I want to go to sleep, leave me alone, leave me alone." You know, they're completely and utterly incapable of physical or mental reaction. Now, that is exhaustion. And I think it is a state which I've seen it since. I've and sometimes partially felt it myself, that I don't think it's really... certainly at the beginning of a war or beginning of a campaign, nobody fully appreciates it. It's a major factor.